You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Isaiah. Today, Pastor Sandy will be teaching from Isaiah chapters 4 through 6.
Notice first, God condemns Jerusalem's overcrowding. You know, throughout the Bible, God likes gardens. Have you noticed that? God likes green spaces. In Isaiah's day, apparently the real estate developers were cramming too many houses in side by side. Oh, it increased the profits, but at the cost of healthy living conditions. Isaiah says, "In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah." In other words, once fertile land will become barren. A 10-acre vineyard will produce a scant 9 gallons of grapes. Now here Isaiah uses several ancient measurements. This is probably not on your calculator, but these were the way the ancients measured things. A bath is equal to about 9 gallons. A homer is not something that Justin Upton hits, but a homer was like 11 bushels. So a bath is 9 gallons, a homer is 11 bushels, an ephah equals 1 bushel. Thus, Isaiah is saying it's going to take 11 bushels of seed to yield 1 bushel of grapes or veggies. This is what uncontrolled development does. It strips the land of its nutrients. Whereas God made the land to be fertile and to produce wonderful crops, it becomes barren because of our overworking it. I hope you notice from this verse that God cares about the environment. He does. Here God goes green. He is concerned about what we do to His creation. And when mankind harms the environment, it eventually brings harm to Himself. He says, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, till wine inflames them." Now here's another woe. Woe to the party crowd. Hey, did you know that beer at breakfast is probably not a good idea? Start drinking first thing in the morning, and there's a problem, man. Here he talks about those that start drinking in the morning and they drink all through the day. Even in Isaiah's day, the people of Judah couldn't wait to wrap their hands around a big cold one. He says the harps and the strings, the tambourine and flute and wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of His hands. Now, certainly the Bible teaches that drunkenness is a sin. But when I read verse 12, the real offense here seems to be leaving God out of the celebration. He says, they do not regard the work of the Lord. The world parties to forget about God. All our celebrations should focus on remembering Him and giving Him honor. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Remember, those were the ones drinking beer at breakfast. They eventually died of thirst. Therefore, Sheol, which is another name for hell, has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. Notice they start out with an ice-cold beer in their hand, but they end up hungry, thirsty prisoners, ultimately inhabitants of hell. According to Isaiah, Judah's party train was headed for hard times on earth, but also some hot times in eternity. I hope you don't believe the common notion that hell is going to be one big party. You don't believe that, do you? I hope not. That everyone in hell will be raised in hell? You know, some people have that idea. You know, I'm going to go to hell and just party it out with my buddies. Don't count on it. That's not true. Sure, some folks are going to party all the way to hell. It says it here in verse 14. He who is jubilant shall descend into it. Some folks are going to party all the way to hell. But once they get there, they're going to discover that the refrigerator's empty. There are no cold ones in hell. In Luke chapter 16, the rich man cried out to Abraham from hell. You remember what he said? Have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. And sadly, no mercy was given. Hey, don't expect a Coors Light Silver Bullet Express to run through hell, cooling everybody off. It won't happen. Realize drinking alcohol may be a matter of consciousness, but understand drunkenness is a sin. Do you know the only cells your body doesn't replenish are brain cells? Did you know that? The average person is born with 17 billion brain cells. And each time he or she consumes large amounts of alcohol, it kills off about 10,000 brain cells. Now, there's a lot of reasons I don't drink, but not the least of which is I need all the brain cells I can get. Take heed to Isaiah, and don't party your way to hell. Notice one more point in verse 14. I think it's interesting. Sheol, which was a Hebrew term for hell, is enlarged. It seems hell grows to fill the demand. And to me, this speaks volumes of the love of God. You remember in Matthew chapter 25, Jesus said that hell wasn't made for man, but for the devil and for his angels, or his demons. God sized up hell for just a few occupants. He never wanted men to go to hell. Hell wasn't made for man. It was made for the devil and his demons. Folks go to hell because they choose to by rejecting Jesus, but it was never God's intention. He loves us too much. It's interesting to me that hell has to be enlarged to meet the demand. Verse 15, people shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. People are brought down, and God is lifted up or exalted. This is the goal of all God's judgments. This is what's needed today. People, as I see it, are riding on their high horse. People need to be brought down. God needs to be exalted. Ultimately, God's judgments will create just that scenario. J. Vernon McKee, he writes in his commentary, in the thinking of the world, God has been removed from the throne of judgment, divested of authority, robbed of his regal prerogative. He has been towed to the edge of the world and pushed over as excess baggage. He is characterized as a toothless old man with long whiskers, sitting on the edge of a fleecy cloud with a rainbow around his shoulders. He is simple, senile, and sentimental. He does not have enough courage or backbone to swat a fly or crush a grape. His place is in the corner by the fireplace where he can knit. This is the world's concept of God. But this is not the God of the Bible. It's not the God that we read about in Isaiah. A God of swift judgment. One day our God will surprise the naive. And yet the second woe ends in blessing. He says, then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places of the fat ones strangers shall eat. When Jesus reigns, there'll be enough leftovers even for the strangers to feast. Here's a third woe. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope. In other words, Judah was prideful. They thought they could sin and not be caught. They drew iniquity with cords of vanity. Verse 19 finishes quoting them, that say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. In other words, if God is going to judge us, let us see him do it now. They're baiting God. They're taunting God. They've reveled in their sin and they've mocked God. And isn't this what modern man is doing today? It was Francis Schaeffer who said, what marks our generation, it's the fact that modern man looks to the universe and thinks nobody is home. Isn't that how people live today? They think nobody's home, that they're all alone, that there's no one to whom they're accountable. People who think that are in for a huge shock one day. Verse 20 is a woe for modern times. He says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Men will rewrite the moral code. And isn't this what's happened today? Tolerance for homosexuality is now the virtue. Any opposition is now bigotry. Pornography is now freedom of expression. Modesty is repression. Abortion is the right to choose. Pro-life is an oppression of women. Hooking up, casual sex is a rite of passage. Virginity, purity is now dysfunctional. Anti-Christian rhetoric is protected by the First Amendment. Biblical teaching is now hate speech. As Isaiah said, evil is called good and good evil. It's coming true before our very eyes. Morality today has been turned topsy-turvy. Cultural norms and mores are being rewritten today. But just realize it's the devil holding the pen in his hand, not God. Reminds me of the music teacher who picked up a mallet and struck a tuning fork. He said to the class, "Here's the good news. That's an A. It's an A today. It was an A 5,000 years ago. It will be an A 10,000 years from now." The soprano upstairs sings off key. The tenor across the hall flats on his high notes. The piano downstairs is out of tune. He hit the tuning fork again. But that is still an A, and that is really good news. And it is. Real truth never changes. Despite man's reinterpretations, God's word is forever immutable. Last week, a man asked me why we didn't make room for female pastors here at Calvary Chapel. I told him we believe the Bible. And the Bible reserves the position of pastor for male leadership. He said, "But Pastor Sandy, that Bible, it needs to be updated from time to time." And that's where we disagreed. Hey, like I said this morning, nobody's getting smarter than God. He knows what he said, and he said it clearly, and I'm sticking to the script. Here's the woe that man needs to hear, as well as we. Verse 21, "Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." Oh, my. Be careful when you think you know it all. I like what one man said. "It's amazing what all I learned after I knew it all." Proverbs 16, verse 25 echoes this verse and explains its wisdom. "There is a way that seems right to man, but its end is the way to death." You see, God sees dangers that we don't see. He's smarter than we are. And we avoid great pain by obeying God. Here's another woe. "Woe to men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink." Oh, the Bible might not prohibit the use of alcohol, but it certainly warns us of its dangers. Beware. Also, woe to the man who justified the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. "Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness and their blossom will ascend like dust, because they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel." "Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them. And the hills tremble. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still." Twice in Israel's history, this prophecy was fulfilled. Jerusalem was toppled, and the people were destroyed. Jerusalem was first toppled in the year 586 BC at the hands of the Babylonians. Later, it occurred in 70 AD at the end of a Roman sword. The carcasses of the Jews literally lay in Jerusalem's streets. Yet, according to Isaiah, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is outstretched still. And thus, the Bible predicts one more final invasion of Jerusalem. The Bible tells us, at the midpoint of this final 7 years of great tribulation, the Antichrist will break his treaty with Israel and will invade Jerusalem. Jews will flee to the wilderness. This is mentioned at the end of Revelation 11. And Isaiah sees this last invasion here, 200 years before the first invasion. And he describes it beginning in verse 26. God will lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Did you know God whistles? Be interesting to hear. Surely they will come with speed, swiftly. He'll whistle for the invaders to come. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt on their loins be loosened, nor the strap of their sandals be broken, whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves will seem like flint and their wheels like a whirlwind. I mean, these invaders are ruthless and they're relentless. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely and no one will deliver. In that day, they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the cloud. God will rally the nations one day together against Jerusalem. Isn't it interesting today how the nations are all lining up against Jerusalem, against Israel? Even our own country seems to be wavering in its support of Israel. It'll be an ominous sight in that day. Israel's only defense will be to turn to God. How ironic, the Almighty God, who was shoved in the corner by the fireplace where he can knit, that the world is scoffed at and relegated as useless, that same God will be seen as Israel's only hope and salvation. And God will come to her defense in a mighty way. Which brings us to chapter 6, a passage that always reminds me of that brilliant theologian Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, he wrote a massive theology, multi-volumes, that he entitled Summa Theologica. Theologica, theology, summa, the total, the summary, the totality of theology. Quite a bombastic name for a book, wouldn't you say? He considered it the sum total of the knowledge of God. And yet, on his deathbed, the Spirit of God came to Thomas Aquinas and revealed to him a vision of God's glory. Afterwards, Thomas wrote this: "What I have seen makes all that I have previously taught and written seem as but chaff or straw to me." You know what this man's saying? This man who had delved into all these theological thoughts, when he saw God firsthand, when God revealed his glory to his heart, he said, all that I had previously learned was like straw in light of the glory of God that was revealed to me. And this was the kind of vision and calling that Isaiah experiences here in chapter 6. He sees God in his glory. The vision is recorded in chapter 6. This was the turning point in Isaiah's life. It shaped both the man and his ministry. Chapter 6 begins. In the year that King Uzziah died, this vision was so monumental in Isaiah's life, he never forgot its date, 740 BC, the year that the king died. This Uzziah was a good and godly king. He had reigned over Judah for 52 years. Tradition suggests that Isaiah was his younger cousin. Isaiah had never known life without Uncle Uzziah. The king was Isaiah's mentor, a spiritual dad, you could say. Their relationship was similar to the bond between Moses and Joshua, or maybe Paul and Timothy. But now, Uzziah has died. Uzziah is gone. Isaiah had lived his whole life in the shadow of King Uzziah, this godly king. But now he finds himself on his own. And we've all experienced this at some point, haven't we? Well, if you haven't, you will. It occurs when you leave home and the support of your parents, or when you're separated from a Christian friend that you used to lean on and trust in, or when a spiritual mentor moves on or even passes away. I'll never forget speaking to a mentor of mine about the calling that God had placed on my life to start a church. I wanted to know what he thought about the idea. And he wisely refused to answer. I'll never forget, he said, Sandy, there comes a point when we all have to listen to God for ourselves. And it's true. When there's no one left but God, for the first time you learn that God is enough. This is exactly what Isaiah learns in this chapter. It was time for Isaiah to dial God direct. It was time for him to come out from under the shadow of the king and forge a firsthand relationship with God. Once Uzziah was out of the picture, Isaiah says in verse 1, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. He saw God's sovereignty. He is sitting on a throne. He saw God's splendor. He is high and lifted up. He saw God's superiority. His train filled up the whole temple. In the Hebrew, this word train is translated shul, or is from the word shul, which refers to the hem or the fringe or the border at the bottom of a robe. Understand, in antiquity, the hem of a garment represented the authority of the person who was wearing the robe. And this is why the priests in the Old Testament, they had special embroidery around the hem of their robes. It marked their priestly calling. David, you remember, insulted Saul. By how? By clipping off the hem of his robe. It was an insult to his authority. In Ezekiel 16, verse 8, God makes a covenant with Israel by covering her with the hem of his robe. Boaz proposed to Ruth by taking her under his wing, or literally by bringing her under the corner of his robe, bringing her under his authority. Recall the woman hemorrhaging from blood. She received healing by mustering the faith to reach out and grab the hem of Jesus' robe. In other words, she was touching his authority. And now when Isaiah sees the train, the hem of God's robe, he sees that it fills up the temple. He realizes that God's sovereignty and his splendor and his superiority are unsurpassed. This God is even greater than he thought. Verse 2 tells us, and above the throne stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. And with two he flew. Now there are two types of varieties of angels mentioned in the Bible. There are cherubim and there are seraphim. And both types are found around God's throne. The word seraphim means burning ones. And apparently, these seraphim have six wings. Six wings. Isaiah says that with two, he covered his face. Apparently, the glory of God was too much for his eyes to behold. With two, he covered his feet. The angel was too humble to stand before God's presence. And with two, he flew. He stayed suspended in the presence of God. It represented his constant worship and his tireless service. And Isaiah hears these angels. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The word holy means set apart. It speaks of God's uniqueness. Hey, when we say that God is love, we say one thing. But when we say that God is holy, we're saying that he loves like no one else loves. When we say that God is faithful, we're saying one thing. But when we say that he's holy, we're saying that he's faithful like no one else is faithful. A holy God is in a class all by himself. No one else compares. God is a cut above. In fact, infinite cuts above.
The book of Isaiah stands out in a unique and powerful way from other Old Testament books. It provides a comprehensive prophetic look at the gospel message. Isaiah points us to Christ in numerous ways, from his birth to his life message to his sacrifice for our sins on the cross. Jesus himself even referred back to this prophet to prove he'd fulfilled what was said. What an incredible way to see the continuity of the Bible. Isaiah prophesied truth, and Jesus fulfilled it. We hope today's teaching from Sandy Adams Radio has encouraged your faith. If you missed any part of the message or would like to share it with someone, you'll find it in its entirety at sandyadams.org. We love that we get to be a part of our listeners' lives through this ministry, and we want to know how you've been impacted by what you've heard. Feel free to call us at 770-736-2828. Be sure to let us know how we can be praying for you. That number again is 770-736-2828. If you're in the Atlanta area, we'd love to meet you in person. Visit us at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain for a Sunday morning of worship and Bible study, as well as meeting some friendly, loving people. Find out more at sandyadams.org. Thanks for joining us today, and be sure to tune in again for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.